Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The oceans cover approximately 66%, or 129 million square miles of the Earth's surface. The oceans contain a stunning amount of marine life, but global warming, whaling, overfishing, and pollution has disrupted the ecosystem with devastating consequences. The good news is that awareness is drastically growing, and it takes awareness and knowledge for people to get involved and take action. That's the goal of the San Francisco Ocean Film Fest. The 9th annual festival kicks off this Thursday, featuring films exploring a range of issues, including efforts to save whales from entanglements, beaches covered in plastic, and the secrets of elephant seals. Joining us to talk about this year's festival and efforts to save our oceans is Ana Blanco. She is executive director of the San Francisco Ocean Film Fest, kicking off this Thursday in San Francisco. Hi, Ana. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Joel Heath. He's director of the documentary People of a Feather. Currents around southern Hudson Bay's Belcher Islands once created a favorable environment for eider. Is it eider?
Eider.
Thank you. Eider ducks, essential to the island's Inuit people. Starting in 1974, hydroelectric development on rivers flowing into Canada's James Bay has altered those currents and even seasonal cycles. Using incredible cinematography and acoustics, this film argues that these northern people's struggle to preserve their world is our struggle too. Hi, Joel. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And we're joined by Dan Griffin. He's director of the short documentary film Ocean Babies on Acid. What happens to ocean creatures when they're exposed to increasing acid levels in the ocean? Stanford University and Bodega Marine Lab scientists conduct an experiment on how acidity levels expected in the next century affect 28,000 genes of tiny young sea urchins. Hi, Dan. Welcome to the show.
Happy to be here.
Great to have you. So, Ana, let's start off with you. Give us an overview of the range of topics in this festival. There's so many.
There definitely are a lot of different topics this year, but I think one of the main threads that we're seeing is that this year is definitely a very international aspect to our films. We have films from over 12 countries and a variety of topics. And what I think I'm realizing is that a lot of the topics, the film may be about a particular country, but the topic itself is universal to all oceans everywhere. A couple of highlights include eco crime investigators from the UK. It's about whaling off the coast of Iceland. We have early learning, which is from Poland, about a young gentleman who starts working at a first responder SEAL center. We also have Bird Island, the story of Isla Raza from Mexico, and the efforts to eradicate rats from the island. So we have a lot of variety of topics, and they all seem to coincide with what's happening everywhere around the world.
I understand you got a large number of international submissions this year.
Yes, we did. We have over 12 different countries represented this year, which is what we're finding, that a lot of the filmmakers are from all over. We probably got more countries that submitted films but weren't necessarily selected. We had over 120 submissions, and we're screening about 46 films.
So before we dive in and talk specifics, let's talk broadly here. The oceans and all of the problems they face are receiving so much more awareness, thanks to movies like The Cove and The Sea Shepherd and Whale Wars. People are talking about this. They understand what the problems are. Well, first off, what really concerns you right now about what the oceans are facing?
I think it's what I'm learning is that it's really how we as humans interact with the ocean, whether it's plastics, whether it's how we treat marine life, whether it's efforts of coastal development that are affecting what we're doing, whether it's ecotourism, and is ecotourism, something that really benefits the marine life is to be questioned. So I think there's just It's how us humans are interacting with the ocean and the effect that we have on the ocean, and how we need to be aware of what we're doing and understand how we need to change our habits, change our behaviors in order to minimize the impact that we are currently having on the ocean.
And Joel, what about you? What concerns you the most about oceans and what we're facing right now?
Yeah, well, from the perspective of the people on the Belcher Islands, it has to do with the currents and the circulation. And our global climate, one of the main factors that drives that is the North Atlantic overturning circulation. And so the issue that we present in the film is that hydro projects, not just in Hudson Bay, but all over the world, are working against the hydrological cycle in terms of harvesting electricity and through hydropower and dams for irrigation. And so we're trying to find ways to work with the hydrological cycle because that's the blood, the pulse of our whole planet.
And so since you brought that up, talk a little bit more about this. Hudson Bay is a large body of salt water in northeastern Canada. How did you first become interested in this topic? It's a fascinating film about the Inuit people on the Belcher Islands in Hudson Bay.
Yeah, I was actually up there for my PhD. I was studying sea ice ecology. The community contacted the Canadian Wildlife Service in the 90s because there was huge die-offs of thousands of birds, and they were concerned about that because it's their main source of clothing and food, both traditionally and in the present day. It's kind of their local free-range organic country food. And so I was up there filming the birds diving underneath the ice, trying to understand their winter ecology, what it takes for them to survive the winter, and heard more and more about how hydroelectric projects, and it was a real surprise for me because I definitely went in with a lot of preconceptions about how climate change was having a big factor, but Inuit really feel that the hydroelectric projects were having an even bigger impact on sea ice ecosystems than climate change. So.
And it was so, I mean, it's a beautiful film, and it was so sad to watch the eider birds struggle to find food. And explain what's happening there, because their sort of little swimming hole, it just seems to be shrinking. So you've got all of these birds trying to swim in this tiny space, and then when they dive under the water to find the food, when they come up, they hit the ice and they struggle to find that little hole where they actually can breathe.
Yeah, so normally these habitats are called polynyas, I think is what you'd be referring to, and often they're a lot bigger than that, and they kind of provide like an oasis in the sea ice, so it's kind of a consistent habitat for them throughout the winter. But there's a few things that are happening that are affecting the dynamics of the ice there. One of it is the currents. Inuit believe the currents have been flowing down generally all along eastern Hudson Bay, and it's kind of the currents, partly tidal, but also other factors that drive the currents, are causing them to slow down, so the ice is increasing. The other thing is that it's complex because the hydroelectric projects influence by a switch. They were kind of reversing the seasons, so the electricity demands peak in the wintertime, whereas spring runoff normally happens in the spring. And so the water that's normally cold snowmelt that rushes into the ocean and cleans the land in the spring is now held behind reservoirs until it warms up, and then they dump it during the wintertime when people turn up the thermostat.
Mm. And Joel, if you can speak up just a little bit, I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Sure.
What is the current status of the eiders and the Inuit people today?
Yeah, the population has since recovered. There was a 75% decline that was documented after these big die-offs in the 90s. The population has come up quite a bit, but we've still been seeing die-off events happen, and they're kind of increasing in their frequency and severity. And the thing to mention, too, is although the relationship between Inuit and eiders is featured in the film, it's really symbolic, and they're really kind of the canary in the coal mine, because these are critical habitats for polar bears, for beluga whales. We're seeing more and more entrapments of beluga whales. So one of the problems is not the warm water that comes from the reservoir. Comes from the reservoirs can keep sea ice from freezing and can cause it to break up earlier in the spring. But so that causes less ice in some situations. But in some situations, it actually causes more ice because freshwater freezes at much warmer temperatures than salt water does. And when you have this huge plume of fresh water on the surface, it really changes those dynamics. And so if you get a sudden cold snap, like extensive areas can freeze up really quickly. And so that's partly why we're seeing more ice and that constraining the birds and also trapping animals like belugas.
That is Joel Heath. He's director of the documentary People of a Feather, which debuts this Saturday at 7 o'clock at the San Francisco Ocean Film Festival. And Dan Griffin, let's bring you in on this. What concerns you the most right now? You were focusing on acidification in your film, Ocean Babies on Acid.
Well, this film looks at but just putting in new facts about climate change. And in Joel's film, what he's seeing is man-made impacts, and that's one of the things that's happening in climate change. There's man-made impacts that are hitting certain parts of the ocean. Climate change and ocean acidification is a bigger picture of that man-made impact. So in this case, what's going on is a time machine. So the film is about a time machine created in a lab where scientists from Stanford and the UC system are creating the ocean of now and the ocean of the future. And then they're watching what happens when the babies or the future animals of the ocean live in that ocean.
And so tell us what happens. What do they find?
So when they brought urchins from four parts of the Pacific coast, from Oregon all the way down to Santa Barbara, they spawn them in the lab. So they bring them together. They have the eggs and the urchin sperm. They spawn them. They keep them all separate. And then in the lab itself, they build a baby sea urchins live in the inner tidal where there's waves and rocks and crashing. So they had to build this splashing zone and this moving zone so the babies are growing up in the same world. So as they watch them, they grow for about 30 days. They change from little spaceship kind of creatures into, when they're just floating around, into the kind that settle down on the rocks and grow the spines. And what they're looking at is, are they going to survive this? And if they're going to survive, are they going to change? And they came up with some interesting things where they thought they were all the ocean babies of the future. They thought a lot of them would die off, but they're finding that they have the ability to change and deal with this change.
Ocean acidification is receiving a lot of media attention. There's just a piece in Time magazine that says ocean acidification is now almost certainly occurring faster than it has for at least 300 million years. And as the rate of man-made carbon emissions increases in the future, acidification will likely only accelerate. That will have dire effects on corals and other ocean life that will struggle to adapt to a marine environment that will be changing, by geological standards at least, at breakneck pace. Dan, do we really understand what we're facing right now?
It's getting to the point where people are just starting to. We did one short film. We were working in the South Pacific, and we brought a piece of coral into a lab, and vinegar is acid, essentially. So we were just going to really highlight what happens when acid and coral come together, because coral, crab shells, oyster shells, little creatures like that grow shells, their shells are calcium carbonate. And when they're in an acid situation, their shell dissolves, their little house dissolves. So they have to spend more energy making their house. And if the ocean is too acid, they can't do it. They won't grow as big, they won't be as robust. And if they die, they're the beginning of the food chain. So we took this piece of coral, we dropped it into a little beaker full of acid, and it looked like an Alka-Seltzer tablet. It just bubbled and spewed, and it just ended up a floppy piece of Jell-O.
Ew.
So, I mean, it was kind of over-dramatizing it, but that's the end effect, is corals will dissolve, and they are dissolving now. It is happening. So it's a thing that's going on, but what they're finding in the science world is that people are able to talk about climate change and fiddle with the facts. So this experiment in this film is about building a layer of fact. This is what we saw, this is what happened. And they're trying not to have preconceived notions. They're going to say, okay, here are facts, this is what's going on.
Here are the facts. That is Dan Griffin. He and his wife, Robin Garthwaite, are directors of the short documentary film Ocean Babies on Acid, and that shows this Sunday at 4 o'clock at the San Francisco Ocean Film Fest. Anna, what are your thoughts? Do you think people really understand what we're facing, and what does it really take to wake people up about these issues?
I honestly don't think that people truly understand the effects of what we're doing on the ocean. In terms of ocean acidification, there's a film that's in production currently. It wasn't completed in time for our entry, but it is about a coral reef off the coast of Cuba. And it's astonishing to see the imagery from that particular coral reef that is abundant with sea life and beautiful corals versus, and it's a coral reef that's been protected for many years versus other coral reefs that we're seeing around the world that haven't been protected and are seeing the effects of ocean acidification. I think what we're seeing mostly is that the filmmakers have the ability to bring these stories and bring these messages to the big screen. Mm-hmm. And until we understand what's happening, I don't think we can institute any type of change. And what the filmmakers are able to do is to share these stories, raise awareness, show the impact of what we're having on our oceans, and then what we can do to become better ocean stewards.
Well, I'd love to hear listeners on this. What do you think raises awareness? The Cove raised so much awareness because it was about the slaughter of dolphins in Taiji, Japan. A lot of people are now aware of why these dolphins are killed. It's to bring dolphins over to sea parks like SeaWorld. So what do you think really grabs people's attention? What really grabs your attention? What's most effective? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. How concerned are you about the state of our oceans? What do you think is most effective? The fact is, there's so much more awareness today than there was 10 years ago, even maybe 5 years ago. And how does that translate into real action? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org, and you can give us a call at feedback@yourcallradio.org. So, Joel, what are your thoughts on what's most effective? How are you getting the word out about what the Inuit people are facing in Canada?
Yeah, this film has been a major way to get that out. That we had been publishing scientific literature, but we realized we really needed to reach a much more general audience with this as well. And so that was part of the motivation. We were able to get this incredible underwater footage of the birds diving underneath the ice for food. And we were really inspired by a few other films. There was an Inuit-made film called Atanajuat, the Fast Runner, that was won at the Cannes Film Festival a while back. And so we figured, you know, if they could do it, maybe we can too, and we can kind of use this footage to try and raise awareness about these issues. And so that's why we've been working on this for the last 5 years, and so it's been really amazing to have it done and to be able to show it to people and to be getting the responses that we've been getting.
What response are you hearing from people who live in the area but might not have much contact with the Inuit people?
We've been getting amazing reviews. We've won a couple of awards at several film festivals so far. We won the best film of British Columbia by the Vancouver Film Critics Circle recently. And, we're hoping that this momentum, like the dialogue that happens after the film, I've been attending as many Q&As afterwards as I can, and so we brought some of the people from the community down for a couple of the screenings as well. Mm. And to see that dialogue starting to happen has been really, really encouraging, and we're hoping that we can use that to open a conversation with the hydroelectric industry as well. Because it's not a doom and gloom kind of film. There's definitely some serious drama that's happening up there, but we're really optimistic that we can find ways that hydroelectric companies can work with the seasons of the hydrological cycle. And if they took a few steps in that direction, I think they could really be a major innovator in new energy technologies that kind of help us get off other fossil fuels and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. If I could add to that too, Rose, we do have a couple of films that I would like to highlight that really do raise awareness about what is happening. We have one on Sunday, March 11th at 1 o'clock from a local filmmaker by the name of Stanley Manasian, and it's called A Fall from Freedom. And similar to The Cove, it studies the history of orcas being caught and sent to ocean and sea parks around the country. So it's really a historical perspective. It's very nicely done. Stanley will be available for Q&A after the film. There's another local one from two filmmakers down in Southern California. It's called Plastic Tide, and it's a short film. Again, it's on Saturday at 7 o'clock, and it really shows the effect of plastics in the ocean after the tsunami last year, which happened right about this time, and how the ocean current is bringing all of that debris to the coast of Hawaii and what they're doing to raise awareness about the plastics that are in the ocean.
Because currently there is a section the size of about of Texas, mm-hmm, of garbage and plastics, mm-hmm, and the sun breaks it down, so it's in little bits.
Exactly.
And so the fish eat it, basically, mm-hmm, because it's so tiny. And a lot of the debris from Japan is making its way over there, and it'll just sort of catch in with all the other junk.
Exactly. Exactly. And I think people aren't aware of how much there is plastic there is in the ocean. And yes, the fish eat it and they just see it. It reduces to a very small size and they end up eating it and kills a lot of wildlife. And then it's not until they're studied that you actually do see the effects of all the plastics that are happening.
You know, it's interesting because it seems like obviously there are a number of ways to come at this. You've got, you know, raising awareness through films. You've got groups like the Sea Shepherd that take things into their own hands.
Exactly.
And say, if the governments aren't going to protect the whales, we are.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the political avenues, the International Whaling Commission, for example, which a lot of people think is so political that obviously the politicians aren't going to do the right thing because at the end of the day, it's about money.
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about how all of those avenues come together?
Well, I think we need to be just aware of what's happening and how all of these different avenues, as you say, are affecting what we do. There's many sides to the same story, obviously. And these films have the opportunity to bring that awareness to the big screen, to the audience. And that's why we pick a lot of the films that we do pick. Not every single film is essentially a case study about anything that's happening in the world. We have films that are just beautiful imagery of the ocean and the wildlife, and some human interest stories as well. But there are definitely a lot of different channels, and there's just different ways for us to be able to present those through films.
What are your thoughts on that, Dan?
Well, the education aspect and getting the story out is one of the best things that can happen, and festivals like this are fabulous at this. I mean, people watch these, they see them. Our film is essentially one of a series of 50-plus films that we've made. So this is we do a series called Microdocs, and at working with Dr. Steve Palumbi, who runs the Stanford Marine Station. And he's a top world top marine biologist, and he likes to tell his stories. I mean, getting the story out is what can happen with film and video. And we have a series called Microdocs. Each one is one idea at a time. So, what is happening in the ocean? We look at things all across the South Pacific, the Caribbean. We tell a story in 2 to 3 minutes, 4 or 5 minutes, and then it's on to the next piece. So that way people can explore, people can take them and use them in universities. They're available free, and it's just the way to do it.
What sort of success stories can you share with us since we have raised awareness over the last couple of years?
Well, one of the things documented in this series of films is the idea of marine protected areas. Mm-hmm. So people have noticed that there are less fish. When you're working on an island, people live on an island, like Joel was talking about, up in the Inuit area. The ocean is where they get their food. We talk with people who've grown up on a remote island, and they say, well, the fish, they're not as many now. And people will come in at night in a trawler and basically wipe out an island's food supply in a couple days. And they're realizing we have to protect the area in front of us. And that's the best way to save the ocean is you look at your area and you say, look at the problems that are affecting what I can see, and you start solving them.
Right. And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. Today we are talking about the 9th annual San Francisco Ocean Film Festival, which kicks off this Thursday. We'd love to hear from you. What does it take to raise awareness about this very serious problem that we're having with the oceans? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Back to your call with Rose Aguilar in just a moment. Here on Local Public Radio, KALW, you can help a young person build a better future by connecting them with real work experience. Students from high schools around the Bay Area are looking for summer internships in areas including information technology and the health sciences. Your company or organization can really make a difference. To find out how, just go to kalw.org. That's kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow we'll have a conversation about how Citizens United is shaping this year's election. The Supreme Court ruling allows corporations and citizens to spend unlimited amounts of money backing specific candidates. We are talking about a lot of money. So how is this affecting politics, and what will it take to remove money from politics? Wednesday, we'll talk about how we can support domestic workers. Today, we are having a conversation about the 9th annual San Francisco Ocean Film Festival kicks off this Thursday, and the films are showing again at Pier 39, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Anna Blanco, Executive Director of the San Francisco Ocean Film Fest. Joel Heath is Director of the documentary People of a Feather, Currents Around Southern Hudson Bay's Belcher Islands in Canada, once created a favorable environment for eider ducks essential to the island's Inuit people. But starting in 1974, hydroelectric development on rivers flowing into Canada's James Bay has altered those currents and even seasonal cycles. And they are seeing the drastic effects of this today. That film airs Saturday at 7 o'clock. And we're joined by Dan Griffin, director of the short documentary film Ocean Babies on Acid, which takes a look at what happens to ocean creatures when they're exposed to increasing acid levels in the ocean. And that screens Sunday at 4 o'clock. And we'd love to hear from you. What concerns you about the oceans and underwater life? What really got you interested or at least grabbed your attention on this issue? What do you think it will take to raise awareness? And what are you concerned about in your area? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to talk about your favorite ocean movie, mine has to be The Cove. We'd love to hear from you. And let's go to our caller, Mary, in San Francisco. Oh, hi, Marie. Hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. I wonder, are all of the, hundreds of thousands of drugs having an impact on the ocean? Chemicals and drugs, I mean to say.
Yeah, like prescription drugs, lots of antibiotics. Dan, do you have any idea?
Yeah, there is something going on locally right now based on that. They're finding that our sea otter population, which has been increasing, has leveled off. And they're finding that the cause is a virus that's coming in from runoff from fresh water. So it's sort of a feline virus. And they're postulating that it's what she was saying, that the extra material in the water, the drugs and all the pollution are degrading just the health of the otters just enough that they can't fight off this virus, and their population is stagnating right now.
Does anyone else have anything on that one? No? What about chemicals, Dan? There's a lot of talk about chemicals that are dumped into the water, the cruise ships that are dumping various chemicals and waste, although they're not supposed to dump waste. Mm-hmm. How is that affecting the water?
Well, if you go to a lot of places, again, reefs are very easy to watch. You don't go in the water, it's sunny, it's clear, and you're swimming across this beautiful sort of, and often it's a green sweeping landscape where there's fronds of things growing, and you think it's looking really great. And you realize this is all algae that is growing because there's so much man-made runoff in the water that it's outgrowing the coral, so it's essentially smothered a coral reef. And now you have what looks like a green field, which people that aren't exposed to it often enough think, oh, this is really pretty, but it's actually showing a reef in decline. So the trick is to keep track of the man-made impacts and minimize them just step by step by step. And that's the one thing that, especially when I work, again, with Dr. Steve Palombi, and he says the ocean can come back. It can heal itself.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because I was in Kauai in December, and it was mostly brown, very few fish, and very little color. And a lot of the locals said it has to do with climate change and also chemicals coming down from the mountains as a result of overdevelopment.
Yeah, exactly. So stuff running off from agriculture is a big impact in a lot of places. The coastlines are really delicate. It's just a little fringe. We're in places where the island is literally 100 paces across. And as the reef degrades, the waves get a little bit, little easier for those waves to come across, and then basically the islands disappear.
Annie, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, along those lines, we have a wonderful film. It's entitled The Great Hooky, and it speaks to the non-native algae that's actually growing in Mauna Loa Bay on Oahu. And the Great Hooky stands for a pulling together in Hawaiian. And it's a community effort to remove the non-native algae that is harming the bay. And this is a great story about how a community is coming together. They're literally going into ankle-deep water and pulling out non-native algae that is smothering the natural growth that's taking place there. And the theory is that all that non-native algae is coming from polluted water, runoff water, et cetera, that is really damaging it. So it's a great film that talks about how people can make a difference and how people can, through raising awareness about the issue, can make a difference.
Well, thank you for calling in, Marie. And Joel, can you also speak to those issues? What changes are you seeing in Hudson Bay, especially changes with marine life?
Yeah, I can speak more to my expertise more in the oceanography and, I guess, the top predators. So we're definitely seeing more die-off events and that kind of thing happen. But there are concerns, and there needs to be a lot more research done about how changing the freshwater, changing it from saltwater to freshwater, affects everything from primary productivity to all the benthic invertebrates and everything in the whole food web. But it's something that there actually hasn't really been any baseline data done whatsoever in the marine ecosystem on this. Hudson Bay is a fairly understudied area, especially in eastern Hudson Bay. So through the charitable society that we've started, we're really just trying to pick up the pieces and try and understand the problem a lot more.
Well, I'm at your website right now, peopleofafeather.com, and the photos are just stunning. They're just gorgeous.
It's pretty beautiful there.
It's just beautiful. How are the polar bears and the seals affected by this?
Yeah, it's definitely a critical habitat for polar bears. It's a fairly understudied population of bears, and you'll be there's quite a few around. But it's interesting there's really only the population of polar bears that are on the west side of Hudson Bay has been the most studied population, and that's also at the outflow of Manitoba Hydro dams as well. So I think there's a lot of factors, and we need to kind of disentangle what's going on there a little bit more.
And have any Canadian politicians seen your film yet? And what's going on with the Canadian government and these issues?
Yeah, we're just kind of getting going. So it was actually just this weekend that we've opened theatrically in Canada. We've been to a couple of film festivals. There definitely have been people in the government. We've been working closely with the Canadian Wildlife Service and Environment Canada. But we're really hoping that we can open up a dialogue directly with the hydroelectric industry and not have to try and enforce that through government or through any kind of legal means. Because we think in the long term, if they were willing to make a commitment. There was a legal obligation for them to do a cumulative impact assessment. So it's not just one dam. It's kind of the effects of all these different projects that are together. So we're not trying to point the finger at any one individual or any one company, but we think that they could really be part of the solution. There's definitely energy demands that do happen that do coincide with the hydrological cycle. There's a lot of the Inuit communities that are directly in proximity to these dams are still burning diesel for a few of those places. They're still burning coal. So we just need to figure out new ways to store and distribute that energy. And we think hydro projects could be...
Oh, Joel, did we lose you? Oh, I think we lost Joel. Sorry about that. Well, that was Joel Heath. Hopefully we'll reconnect with him. He's director of this incredible documentary, People of a Feather. It's just gorgeous, really amazing footage. And it shows Saturday at 7 o'clock at the San Francisco Ocean Film Festival. Again, it really focuses on the struggles that the Inuit people are facing in Hudson Bay's Belcher Islands, once a favorable environment for the eider ducks. But because of climate change and hydroelectric development, it's so heartbreaking to see the ducks have such a tiny space in which to swim, and then they dive down for food, and when they come up, they hit the ice. Mm-hmm. And they're trying so hard to find the puddle so they can actually breathe, but it's not easy.
Mm-hmm. It's the footage is amazing, and to see the ducks suffer and not have a way out, and to see their puddle get smaller and smaller over time, the cinematography is incredible, and thanks to Joel and his team for bringing that message to us and for really showing us the impact that the hydroelectric dams are having on that particular, not only on the ducks, but it just spreads out into the community and how the Inuits sustain themselves and their lifestyle as a result of it.
And the Inuits, when they see the ducks struggling, they go over to try to make the puddle bigger, but the ice is so hard that even just taking one chunk mm-hmm. out takes so much work.
Exactly.
Today we are speaking about the San Francisco Ocean Film Festival. It's in its ninth year, and it kicks off this Thursday in San Francisco. You can check out these films at Pier 39. You can find the festival guide at yourcallradio.org. Ana Blanco is executive director of the festival, and we have Joel Heath back. He's director of the documentary People of a Feather. It shows Saturday at 7 o'clock. Dan Griffin and his wife, Robin Garthwaite, are directors of the short documentary Ocean Babies on Acid. What happens to the delicate ocean creatures when they're exposed to increasing acid levels in the ocean? That shows Sunday at 4 o'clock. And we'd love to hear from you. What is one of your favorite films about the ocean? And what really has opened your eyes to both the beauty of the ocean and just what it faces? Because there's always two sides to this. There's so much beauty and there's also so much despair. And so what are your thoughts on that? And what really raises awareness about what our oceans and underwater life are really facing right now? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you work with oceans, if you work with children to raise awareness, we'd love to hear from you. You can leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Joel, we got a listener who called in wanting to know if a DVD is going to be available so the film can be shown.
Yeah, we're currently working on finishing up the behind the scenes and special features. We're almost there. We're going to have a limited edition pre-release. It's going to be distributed to Community Society fairly soon, and then the full release should come up early this summer, late spring.
Great.
But right now we're just focused on our theatrical distribution.
All right. And Dan, what about your short films? Where can they be seen?
So we have a website called microdocs.org, and there's 30 or 40 of these short pieces there. And they're also, they've been used in Discovery. They're used in websites all around the world.
Great. So we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. And speaking of children, Ana, you wanted to talk about the programs at the festival that are working with children.
Right. Two things I wanted to highlight about this year's festival. It is our ninth annual San Francisco Ocean Film Festival, and it is North America's premier cinema aquatic event. And one of the things we've always wanted to do over the years is launch our international program. So this year, for the first time, we have a traveling program with Hong Kong. So for the next 2 weeks, beginning on March 8th, this Hong Kong is going to be featuring many of the films that have been in the Ocean Film Festival for their audience, and the response is overwhelming. For us to be able to have these films not only on our big screen, but to be able to send the films to other cities that also want to know about what's happening in the ocean and using film as a medium to to raise awareness is one of our goals. And so Hong Kong has been our first, and the response is just overwhelming. We also have our sixth annual free student program, and over 750 high school and middle school kids will be able to attend and see a select group of films taken from our full lineup. And it's really about educating the next generation. Mm. And for a lot of these kids, they're kids who may not have ever even been to the Bay, haven't crossed the bridge, haven't even been down to a beach before. But wow. For them, it's an opportunity for them to learn about what's happening in their ocean. And for them, it's a field trip, and they get to go to see the films and also have access to the Aquarium of the Bay. So they get a tour of the aquarium.
You know, I would love to be there when a child goes to the beach for the first time. What is their reaction? What really speaks to them?
I think it's just how big it is, the beauty of it. Mm. And yesterday we had the opportunity to team up with Surf Rider Foundation, and we went down to Ocean Beach and we did a beach cleanup. And there were a lot of student groups who were participating, and it was shocking to see how the kids responded to the things that they did find on the beach. So, you know, in a matter of 2 hours, they probably collected over 30 bags of garbage.
Wow.
And the kids themselves go out and actually learn about what's out there and what's happening. So for them, it's very eye-opening. And so for the kids to then go and see these films on the big screen also helps to teach them a lesson.
It's amazing that there's still so much trash on the beaches.
Mm-hmm.
No matter where you go, you find it.
Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to point out that this year we also launched our first student film competition.
Oh.
So we opened it up to middle school and high school students, and we got a really, really good response. We have some winners, local winners from Lowell High School, very excited to show their film. It's called The Mermaid, A Story of Restoration, and it is about their interest in restoring the bay. And it is a beautiful film that includes poetry, cinematography, artwork, and the kids just really had a great time doing it. They're going to get a very nice award at our awards program. And we've always wanted to do this as well. And with the support of our donors, we've been able to do it. But what it's really doing is two things. It's teaching the kids about what's happening in the ocean and piquing their curiosity, and also engaging them in the art of filmmaking.
Mm.
So the films we received were wonderful. We got some from Southern California. We'll do it again next year. And it's for us, it's a way to engage the kids and also help raise awareness for the next generation.
Oh, that's great. When is that film showing?
Their film is showing Friday during the education program, but it's also showing on Saturday night at 7 o'clock during our awards program.
Great. And again, the films are showing at Pier 39 in San Francisco, and you can find the program at yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Kala in San Francisco. Hi, Kala. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just got in my car a little while ago, so you may have already talked about this, but you brought up the issue of trash, and I keep thinking about that big pile of garbage tons that was coming from Japan.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's anything through movies or anything at all that we can do to anticipate that, or, you know, that's where my concern is. And I'm from Hawaii originally, and I'm sure Hawaii is going to be engulfed by garbage as well. But do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, we briefly touched on it. There was a film at the San Francisco Green Film Fest last year called Bag It, which raised awareness about plastic and what it's doing to the environment. What else, Anna? How can you tackle this issue? Because I understand there's no way it can be cleaned up.
There's no way. I don't think there's a way it can be cleaned up. There's a lot of efforts that are underway to try to clean it up. Our friends in Hong Kong are part of the Ocean Recovery Alliance, and they are spearheading efforts to see what they can do, since they're closer to it, to actually go and try to clean it up and to fix it. I think it just goes back to the fact that the overwhelming amount of garbage that's there is plastic.
Right.
So it's single-use plastic bags or should not be used. Everything we do use with plastic, we should be aware of. Choose not to use anything that comes in plastic or buy anything that comes in plastic.
And call the company when you receive a tiny item and a lot of packaging,
mm-hmm.
and find out why they're doing this.
Exactly.
Dan, any other tips?
It's one by one, when a person thinks about what they're doing and looks at what they can do, that's the best way to do it. It's just little by little, and then using their power of what they buy and what they don't buy.
Mm-hmm. And many cities across the country are implementing these plastic bag bans. Mm-hmm. So you've got the individual action, but what about government action here?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's, you know, San Francisco obviously imposed a ban on plastic bags. San Jose did as well. And I keep hearing, every time I turn on the radio, I hear about another city doing the same. And I think what's interesting is when I travel to another city and I get a plastic bag, I've gone to the grocery store, and it's just so odd. I think people should be writing to their government officials. They should be trying to get a ban passed like we are here in San Francisco, because I can see the effects. I can see the difference that it's making. I see more people walking in with reusable bags. And I think it's a matter of being vocal about it and writing your politicians, mm-hmm. and getting them to adapt what we've been able to do here in San Francisco.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Carla. And let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello.
Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks. Couple of things. Just an anecdote. I shop at some natural food stores where I live, and you can virtually not find a product that isn't in plastic. I tried to buy mustard and ketchup in a glass container, and they don't sell it. Whole Foods doesn't sell it. So just... there's an example of, you know, what you're up against. I mean, it seems like everything is being made out of plastic. I don't know if that can be turned around or not. And secondly, in terms of learning about this, I only have a real limited knowledge of this. Your program's helping, but I also seen a little bit on public television, not much. So I'm not sure how widespread or disseminated the information is. And I think that basically, it seems to me that not only the oceans, but there's so many different assaults on the environment from so many different places that it's almost mind-boggling to think about what would have to happen. We would have to dramatically change the way we live,
right,
in order to stop the impacts we're having. And I'll make one suggestion about distribution. I watch mostly public television, if I watch TV at all. And the unfortunate thing is there's a lot of repetition on public television. I'm going to try and get the local public television stations, I don't know if I can do it, both KQED and KTH, to try and have at least a documentary series, maybe once a month, maybe once a week, where they will show documentaries on public television, which I think would be better than some of the programming that's on there, as a way of getting information out, mm-hmm. about a lot of subjects, but it seems to me that's a source.
Yeah, well, and that's what Link TV does so well, but you have to have dish or satellite to get that one.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any relationships, Anna, with the public television stations to carry these films?
Well, we do. KQED has been a big supporter of the festival. They've have their own films that we tend to screen in our film festival. They're just the right topics or the right message that we need to communicate, so we provide a bigger platform, or an additional platform, I should say. But for the most part, our films are independent films, and they're seen at the festival. We are launching, like I said earlier, our traveling program, so not only in international countries and cities, but also across the United States, to get these films out there yet again, to get them onto another screen.
And Joel, we're receiving a few emails from listeners who say that the only way that we can really tackle this issue is if we alter our way of life and stop this overconsumption, which seems to be getting worse around the world. And when we talk about these issues, I often think about indigenous communities who practice sustainability. And I'm wondering what the Inuit people wanted the message to be when you were making this film. I mean, they still practice sustainability, but what do they think about what's going on and what we're facing, and what did they really want you to convey in this film?
Yeah, we've definitely talked a lot about kind of the hydroelectric side of things, and that's definitely an important part of the film. But I think first and foremost, it is a cultural film. It's about the people's way of life and kind of comparing how they lived in the past to their, and how they've incorporated that into their kind of modern culture. And that's the thing, they are living very, very sustainably. They're still getting local free-range organic food off the land. And so I think we do have a lot to learn from them about sustainability and to try and think about how we can kind of incorporate some of that too. So part of it's the challenge of thinking about Inuit innovation and their technology and how something as simple as a feather can keep people warm and get them through the winter in such harsh environments. Mm. So part of that is a challenge is when something that simple can provide a technological solution, there has to be ways that we can find new solutions as well, new energy solutions, new ways to work with our hydrological cycle. And so I think it really is a challenge to us in the South to be able to live sustainably and to find new energy solutions.
What are your thoughts about that, Dan? One listener says, where is the film to talk about how people are not choosing to change their lifestyle of convenience, whether they're aware of some polar bear, a mammal, seabird, for example, the marine mammal tissues along with ours are still toxic dumps when tested?
It seems that people have a great ability to work against their own best interests. That's just one of the things that's going on. And the education thing is the only thing. If you brought people into the Ocean Film Festival and they watched a series of films for 3 or 4 hours, they'll see so many different points of view, so many different approaches, that it does start sinking in. It's like, oh, look, oh, look, oh, look. And people, they love the ocean. And that they can, they say, oh, well, should we destroy the ocean? They'll say no. And they'll, it's just that getting that just that first step of saying, oh, it's in my best interest not to do this. And it's really not that hard. And then the small steps are what people can do. The big steps are what scientists can do and what government can do. Some of the scientists that we work with, they say, anybody who's a marine biologist has become a conservation biologist at this point. Mm-hmm. And I talk to people who are some of the world's experts on coral, and they say, I come back sometime from trips, and it's almost like I have post-traumatic stress, because the place that I was 30 years ago that was just an Eden, a fairyland, is now like that bay you saw in Kauai, just a brown waste. But what they're saying is, if everybody starts taking these steps, it can come back.
And Anna, final thoughts? We have 30 seconds.
Please join us for the films. As Dan said, it's really about education. And what I like to say is that the films are there to entertain and educate and also engage us into becoming better ocean stewards.
Anna Blanco is executive director of the San Francisco Ocean Film Fest. Joel Heath is director of People of a Feather, showing Saturday at 7. Dan Griffin is director of the short doc Ocean Babies on Acid, showing Sunday at 4 o'clock. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Support for Your Call. How is Citizens United shaping this year's election? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the Supreme Court's ruling, which allows corporations and citizens to spend unlimited amounts of money backing candidates. With the proliferation of so-called super PACs and with so much money flowing to both parties, how has politics been influenced by big money? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What will it take to remove money from politics? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Chuck Feeney of Your Legal Rights. Please join me this Wednesday evening at 7 when we'll discuss the Three Strikes Reform Act of 2012. My guests will be retired Judge Eugene Hyman, Karen Guidotti, Chief Deputy of the San Mateo County District Attorney's Office, Jeff Hayden, Certified Specialist in Criminal Law, and Michael Romano, Director of Stanford Law School's Three Strikes Project. That's this Wednesday evening at 7 on Your Legal Rights on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Just ahead here.
here on Local Public Radio, the BBC's World Have Your Say, followed at noon by The State We're In from Radio Netherlands. At 1 o'clock, it's Alternative Radio, and this afternoon at 2, the BBC's NewsHour.
Hello, Ben James here. Welcome to The Conversation. This is the BBC's World Have Your Say.
To all those who support us in every corner of our vast motherland, thanks to all who said yes to a great Russia. I once asked you, will we win?
Vladimir Putin has been at the top of Russian politics since 1999. He's just been elected president for a third time. Although some people are questioning whether the vote was fair, he's undoubtedly popular with many Russians. So is he one of the world's great leaders? Emmanuel in Accra posted on Facebook, "Great to be back, Putin. We need you to put an end to the continuous Western bullying of smaller nations." Do you agree? Post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay.